All right, good afternoon, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. There'll probably be a few other folks trickling in, but we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Carrie. I'm a director of product marketing in the Windows Azure product marketing team, and I also have Venkat, who is a senior product marketing manager on my team. And today we're going to spend a little bit of time giving you an overview of Azure, the platform, and the capabilities associated with the platform. And then Venkat's going to take you through four scenarios and show you a little bit of how you can actually get hands-on with Azure today and take advantage of it in your existing environment. So before we go ahead and get started, I just want to get a feel for the room. How many of you are using cloud computing today? Just a quick show of hands. Okay, good. How many of you are actually managing the applications or infrastructure that is running in the cloud today? Okay, good. So some good experience there. And then lastly, how many of you have played around with Azure? Okay, so we've got some good experience in here. That's great to see. We've seen a lot of people go down to the booth and ask a lot of questions, so interest is there, and hopefully you're getting the information that you need. So let's go ahead and just get started. First of all, we just want to level set the room in terms of why consider the cloud. So there are some key drivers behind why customers are even looking at the cloud as part of their strategy. And it really comes into three key points: speed, scale, and economics. When we think about speed, there's two aspects of speed that come into play. First is your developers can develop their applications more quickly by leveraging cloud resources. And this is twofold. One, because there's many languages that the back-end platforms support, but secondly, also because the resources are instantly available to them. So they can take advantage of cloud services and they can spin up infrastructure really quickly. Once they get that infrastructure and those applications up and running, if they want to go global with those services, it's very easy for them to move into global markets at a more rapid pace. So the second area that they think about is around scale. When you think about scale, spinning up and making more resources available on demand when the application needs it becomes critical as you move out to more services across the environment. Now, there's many, many more devices that are accessing applications today. Some of them are internet-facing, some of them are intranet-facing. But the ability to scale on demand and, again, reach that global market, whether it's scale compute, whether it's scale storage, whether it's scale memory, the cloud gives you that ability to burst at a very rapid pace. And then finally, the economics associated with cloud computing. Now, in some cases, there's true TCO and cost plays associated with the cloud. In other cases, the economics really comes in the ability in how you purchase and leverage the resources. So if you want to do a pay-as-a-go and only use the resources for the period of time that you need them, if you want to spin those resources down and not have to pay for them when they're not being used, these are some examples of how cloud economics can help you move your business forward more quickly. So As we think about the benefits that cloud provides, we also have a number of innovation challenges that I'm sure you guys are dealing with every single day. As the business comes to you and they say, we want to do things faster, we want to be able to scale more quickly. And some of the challenges that we often hear as we're talking to you is, how do I integrate with my existing IT investments? So most certainly there's a diverse environment that you have in your data centers today. You may be running Windows Server 2008, you may be using virtualization, you may be migrating into Server 2012. And for everything that you've just recently deployed and all of the workloads running on top of that infrastructure, you want to make sure that you can continue to manage those assets and continue to gain value out of those assets while also looking forward into how do you meet the growing needs of the business to be more agile. So how do you take advantage of what you have today and then also take advantage of what the cloud can bring you in your strategy in the future? The second key thing that we hear about is around the heterogeneous environment. So in your environment today, you may have a number of different operating systems. Certainly we know many of you are running Windows. It actually powers about two-thirds of the servers that are around the globe. But there's also instances where you're running Linux as well. In addition to the operating systems, there's .NET development that's happening. There's Java development that's happening. And then as you move into the other frameworks, there's other things that your developers are using. And then if you think about the consumerization trend that's happening and bring your own devices, I'm sure many of you are dealing with how do you, address the application compatibility with all these devices. It doesn't really work all the time. So what are my options there as I think about the cloud? How can my cloud strategy help this heterogeneous environment? And then lastly, security and compliance by far is something that is always top of mind for businesses. So whether it's securing your data, whether it's securing your data center, whether it's securing the infrastructure resources, you always are thinking about security. And when you move into the cloud, compliance actually takes another pivot as well, because some of you have regulatory requirements that you have to consider when it comes to data and how some of that data is managed. As we think about Azure and the enterprise needs, we really take all of these challenges and all of this innovation, and we put it into three key buckets. And we call that the enterprise needs integration, heterogeneity, and security in any solution that they're going to bring forward as part of their strategy. And with Windows Azure, we believe these fundamentals are really intact. And we want to take you through a little bit of this today, and then Venkat's going to actually show you some of these scenarios to enable these as well. Now, when we think about integration, we're really thinking about the combination of on-premise and the cloud. We're not asking you to make an or decision here. In fact, we think an or decision would probably be the wrong direction because there are a number of resources that you're taking advantage of today. They're running very well in your environment, and you want to continue to maintain those. However, as you think about going forward in the future, there are going to be scenarios where cloud is going to make sense for you. And Azure is a platform that can be that cloud backend for you. You've probably seen this diagram before. This is the Cloud OS vision. And behind the Cloud OS vision is really the Windows Server platform. We have Windows Server on-premise, we have Windows Server at the service provider, and then we have Windows Azure in the Microsoft data centers. Windows Azure is built on the Windows Server foundation. In fact, we've just updated all of our data centers to Windows Server 2012. So everything that runs on Windows Azure right now is running on Windows Server 2012. The key capability here is we want to have one consistent platform that you can run your services on. So whether you choose to run those services and manage them in your own data center, whether you choose to use the VM portability and run those in Microsoft's data center on Windows Azure, or whether you decide to move that into a hoster, you have the same platform and you get portability across all of those environments. And as you can see around the wheel, you'll probably identify with many of these capabilities because you're using virtualization in your environment today. You have Active Directory deployed, and you have identity on-prem that you're going to need to synchronize into the cloud. You have many development languages. So there's a lot of opportunity here to create a robust hybrid environment and take advantage of cloud resources in Azure in your strategy going forward. In addition, the next area we just want to talk about and hit on lightly is the heterogeneity part. So we talked a bit about the fact that, you know, you may have a lot of .NET development on-premise today. Your developers may also be using Java. As they go into the cloud, they may decide that they want to take advantage of open source frameworks. So you need to provide them a back-end infrastructure that's going to scale with the applications that they're developing and also accommodate the languages that they want to develop in. Now, when most people think about Microsoft, they think Windows. Azure has to be a broader platform. So, of course, we're always going to be first and best on Windows, but we also have to make sure that we accommodate the heterogeneity that you guys have in your environment today so that we can move forward and help you enable your businesses. Another example, in terms of devices, we talked a little bit about the consumerization of IT. So, through our mobile services capabilities and just through the nature of cloud computing, you can now take advantage of enabling various devices in your environment without having to go heavy on the infrastructure side of it. And we provide diversity in the databases as well. If you want to run SQL Server, certainly it's available for you. However, if you're taking advantage of big data and you're punching in through Hadoop, Windows Azure supports that as well. So the last area we just want to hit on is that security component. And what we hear from a lot of customers is that if they're going to go with a cloud provider, they want to ensure that that cloud provider is a trusted partner for them. And we want to talk a little bit about transparency and how we share information with you around the Windows Azure. And particularly, we just want to talk through some of the security and compliance pieces. So at Microsoft, you're very familiar with our trustworthy computing initiative in the way that we build products that are secure by default. So we take security very serious in everything that we do. And whenever possible, we work with standards bodies throughout the industry to ensure that we're aligned with those. So we work closely with the Star Alliance. We work closely with the ISO certification piece. And of course, there are many regulatory compliance requirements such as ISO and HIPAA and FSMA and things of that nature that industry-specific businesses need to make sure that they're accommodating. So we work across those governing bodies to make sure that Azure is certified as well. All the information around those certifications you can find out on our Trust Center, out on the Windows Azure Trust Center. The information's there. If you need more information, you can work with your account rep and they can get it for you. Another area where we're being transparent is in terms of our service dashboard. So if any time you're running Azure services, whether you're using our first-party services or if you're using our infrastructure services, meaning virtual machines on Azure, you can go out and get real-time status of all of the data centers and all of the services around the globe. It's a website. It's available 24/7. You get all the status there. And we openly communicate what is happening in each one of those data centers as the service status changes, which is not very often. And then lastly, we have monthly SLAs associated with the platform and all of the services that we provide. And I know you guys are probably under pretty stringent SLAs within your own environment because you have to deliver service on behalf of the business. And when the server goes down, you're the first one to get the call, and you know we are breaching an SLA. When is service coming back up? So we make that commitment to you as well. We need to ensure that if we're going to be trusted partners together, that there's a level of SLA associated with it. Now, we calculate our SLAs based on monthly calculations as opposed to yearly calculations. So we don't try and average over a year. We basically look at availability on a month-to-month basis. And all of our SLAs are backed financially. So we're making a pretty significant commitment to ensure that we're running your services very well or in integrating with your on-prem. Another area that we just want to talk about in terms of trustworthiness is around the relationship. So each time you guys come into the executive briefing center, and I'm sure many of you have been there before, possibly your leadership teams have been there, we often get asked the question around, hey, Microsoft, you guys are running this stuff at a global scale. How can we learn from you? How can you help us architect our environment so that we can be successful as well, so that we can avoid the pitfalls that you may have learned during your dog fooding process? So we completely expect and hope that we'll continue to work with that as you build your cloud strategy and Azure becomes part of that cloud strategy. In an effort to do that, we've also simplified the way that you can procure Azure resources. So for your existing enterprise agreement, go ahead and just attach it to it. You don't have to go out to the website and credit card any resources. You don't have to do anything that's overly complex. You can just build it into your existing agreements. All of your support that comes in, whether you have a technical account manager or support resources on site, you can take advantage of all of those for Azure too. So making it really easy for you to integrate with your existing environment. And I'm not going to spend a ton of time here, but people often think that Azure, you know, is one of our first forays into the cloud. And in fact, it's not. It's one of our later forays, so to speak. Our first data center opened back in 1989, and you can see that there's a number of services that we run as first-party services in the cloud. And when you look at numbers like 9.9 billion messages, 600 million unique users, you know, 500 million live meeting, conference meetings, we're talking big numbers. We're talking big scale here. So we definitely want to take that experience, share it with you, so again, you can avoid some of those pitfalls going forward as you think about your cloud strategy and taking your business to the next level. So based on those that quick overview, we really believe that you'll find that Windows Azure is enterprise ready by design, and we're going to take you through a little bit of that here in just a couple minutes. In terms of transparency, there's one other piece that I want to bring across for you, just because I know you guys like data centers and you like toys and all sorts of racks and stacks and stuff. We often get asked, like, okay, so Windows Azure is this thing in the cloud, but what does it actually look like? Can you make it tangible for me? So let's make it tangible here. Global data centers. We have global data centers in 8 regions throughout the globe. We continue to take feedback from customers and we watch workloads and all of that nature to determine if we should be expanding. So there's 8 global data centers. A couple pictures for you. You know, for those of you, many of you that are running data centers, that one in the middle probably looks familiar, you know. You get the Christmas tree glow light as you walk down the data center hallway. Very, very familiar to you. The one on the left is our Chicago data center, and you can see these are the pods that all of the compute comes in. And they're pretty big boxes. And then they get moved in by our Global Foundation services and racked into the data center themselves. We've got 24 global CDN locations that help us deliver content to the end user devices around the globe. And then from a global support perspective, our Microsoft Global Foundation services is really the IT guys like you that are running the services behind the scenes. So they're managing all of the Microsoft global services around the world. And we have a number of global support centers to make sure that we're as responsive as possible to both folks on the ground and in the data centers as well. And if you look at some of the numbers there, over a billion customers running on top of Microsoft services as a whole and 20 million businesses across 76 markets, those are pretty significant numbers. And these guys have tons and tons of experience on running at a global scale. So again, just recognizing the confidence there in terms of the ability. And then you'll continue to use your local account teams. And for those of you that have a need to purchase in local currency, that's available for you to do. And you can attach that through your EA as well. So as we think about the Windows Azure platform, what actually is it? What's available to me? There's three classes of services that we make available through the Windows Azure platform. There's app services, data services, and infrastructure services. And the first two are the app and data services. And these are the things that your developers are really going to take advantage of. These are services that they can use as building blocks to help them expedite the creation of an application. Now, these services are built by Microsoft to enable developers to move faster. So as a developer is building their application, they can insert these as components as part of their application. If the application needs to burst, they can take advantage of these services, and Azure will automatically adjust the bandwidth and needs associated with that. Now, the infrastructure services is probably something that's more applicable to IT, although we see a lot of developers taking advantage of it, again, because of speed and scale. Now, Azure data center, your data centers, this is where IT comes into play, and you can actually deploy virtual machines in the same way that you deploy virtual machines on site. You can manage them in the same way that you manage them today through System Center. The ability to take these virtual machines, load them into the cloud, and then connect them through virtual networks and VPNs so that they punch down and communicate to your on-premise data center is fully available through Azure. And Venkat's going to show you some of that today in terms of how you do that. And there's a couple different ways that you can take advantage of the virtual machines. We're going to provide some for you by default, so you don't even have to build them. You just choose them and spin them up. You'll have the ability to import them, or you can use open source images. So depending on what the business needs are associated with your application and your infrastructure, you've got a lot of flexibility there. But the key takeaway here is to think about application services and data services are first-party services that Microsoft provides so that your developers can integrate them into their applications, and we manage those. For infrastructure services, this is where you get a little bit more configuration and management control, and the responsibility of managing these virtual machines relies within IT or the developer that's leveraging them. With that, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Venkat, and he's going to talk you through a couple of scenarios that you can use today to get started with Windows Azure, and he's also going to take you inside the management console a little bit so you can see how some of these things actually work.
Thanks, Kerry. All right, so now that we basically know what Windows Azure is, and essentially it's a bunch of building blocks, right? Finished services that you can do, that you can build applications, or you can build data center in the cloud fully. What I'm going to do is I'm going to just focus on four scenarios, the first of which is basically using Windows Azure as a giant hard drive in the cloud, right, for your backups and recoveries and so on. Fairly easy to use Windows Azure in that manner. Second one is the test and dev scenario. Third is basically extending your infrastructure, and we'll talk through each of these. And the last one is basically use Windows Azure in areas where you wouldn't think of using your own data center, right? So before we talk about using storage, let's take this example of what really happens in your data centers. If you basically ask organizations, how is the data growing over time? This is how your data basically grows, right? 50 to 60% annually. this is what IDC says organizations are facing. Is that something you guys are noticing as well? 50 to 60% sound about right? Throw out a number? Okay. So data is growing exponentially, but what is happening is that the most frequently used data that you actually need on-premises more or less follows that green line. So if you think about where is that you can basically put data, the difference between the blue line and the green line is the possible opportunity for you to start using cloud as a storage, right? Now, there might be reasons like compliance and performance and even network costs that might prevent you from putting some of the data in the cloud. But that is how you want to think about, right? That is the data that you can potentially put inside the cloud. And if you were to use on-premises SAN storage for a bunch of these things, turns out SAN storage is expensive. And Forrester had a stat out there. Basically, it's four times as expensive as cloud storage when you start factoring in IT staffing costs and overheads and so on and so forth. So the complexity of managing storage on-premises is removed by basically using cloud as a storage option. So fundamentally, conceptually, that is the area where you want to use cloud for storage. Let's now talk a little bit about the Windows Azure storage system. Like I said earlier, it's a giant hard drive, right? That's the easiest way to think about it. Today, it has about 4 trillion objects. It processes about 120,000 requests per second, and during peak times, that number goes up to about 1 million requests per second. So it is a ginormous scale all over the globe, the storage system that we have in place in Windows Azure. It is a very highly, it is a highly durable and available storage. In fact, every file that you copy in Windows Azure, we make three copies of that across different racks and servers. That provides availability. So if one file server, one storage server were to go down or a rack were to go down, you still have your data accessible, right? And that's backed by financially backed SLA of 99.9%. We also support REST APIs, so, and we have a lot of third-party tools that you can actually use to talk to the storage system. Or if you want, you can also build your own tools to talk to the storage system. Yet another cool feature about Windows Azure storage system is that not just three copies of, you know, your data are made in a local region, we also asynchronously copy that data into a region far away, hundreds of miles away. So that protects you against regional disasters. So basically, you can use Windows Azure storage system then to factor into your DR plans as you're thinking about backups and backups and archival and that kind of storage, right? So with that, what I want to quickly do is show you in the management console how you can set up a storage account and maybe just store a file there in the Windows Azure storage system and just walk through that workflow, how that feels and looks like. Okay, looks like my laptop slept there. Okay, so I'm in the Windows Azure management console now. I've logged in, and the first thing that you want to do is you want to basically go to storage and create an account, and we'll do that now. So I go to new. It's a fairly simple, straightforward process. Go to storage and quick create. It will ask me the URI that I need to access that storage account, and I'm just going to create one, right? MMS Demo Store 123. Here is the option which is by default selected for geo-replication that I talked about earlier. You can, of course, you know, if you have compliance reasons and you don't want to have that data copied in two different regions, you can unselect that, but I'm going to leave that on that way. Done, right? It's as simple as that, creating a storage account. Just a couple of clicks, storage account is there. While it's creating, what I will do is I will show you another account that I already created, and just to give you a look, you know, what it looks like in the management console. If you see, MMS Demo is the other storage account I have already created. There's a dashboard that gives me a bunch of monitoring information, availability, the total requests, and so on and so forth. The other thing that you want to take notice of is the Manage Access Keys icon down here. Every storage account gives you two access keys. These are the authentication mechanisms to authenticate with the storage system. There are two because if one of them you're regenerating, you don't want to lose access to the account. That's why we provide you two keys. The last thing I want you to take note is the containers. So essentially, once you create a storage account, what you want to do is create containers. Containers are just like folders that you create on a drive, right? You use containers to logically organize your blobs or objects. And here, I already have created basically two containers in there. One is called Backup, and the other called VHDs. And using a third-party tool now, which supports Windows, which is integrated with Windows Azure, I'm going to show you how to simply copy a file into one of these containers. So let's go and set that up. So I have this tool called Cloud Explorer. I'm going to associate the Windows Azure account with this tool. So just go ahead and create a new Windows Azure account here. That was the name of the account, MMS Demo. And the secret key, basically, I'm going to pull from okay, my internet is really fast here. I'm going to pull from this. And done. Essentially, now I'm basically seeing the same containers that you were seeing in the management console, right? So inside the backup container now, what I will do is I'll simply copy a file from my desktop. Just to give you an example of how you can start using Windows Azure in a very simple manner. Once this is done, if you were to go back to your management console, go into your containers, you can actually see the actual object that was copied, right? Because it's nothing but a binary large object or a blob. So this was just a simple example to show you how easy it is to set up a storage account and to start using it for your backups and recoveries and so on and so forth. And this file now, essentially, there are three copies that are made and three copies in a faraway location. So it's really disaster-proof. Okay, now switching back, I want to give you a couple of examples of how you can start using Windows Azure Storage System by some of the first-party solutions that we have in place for you to start using. First of which is a solution called StorSimple. What StorSimple does is it's a device that sits on-premises, behaves and feels like a SAN storage device. It uses iSCSI to connect to your application service, looks like an iSCSI drive. But the magical thing it's doing is that whatever data that you are putting in StorSimple solution in the device there, it is tracking which of that is frequently accessed and which of that is not frequently accessed. So it's tiering data. And the data that is actually most used, it is keeping on premises in SSD and actual hard drives. The rest of the data, it is silently backing up to Windows Azure. And the way it does it is very efficient. It is going to compress it. There is deduplication it does. And it also encrypts for security. So all these things are being done automatically by the device that is sitting on premises. So it kind of acts like a gateway to Windows Azure, right? A very nifty and easy way to start using Windows Azure for storage, backup, and recovery purposes. So if you guys are more interested in the solution, there is a session later on at 2 o'clock. You want to go and check that out. If you can't make that, there is also a booth that you want to go and quickly see a demo of how the solution works. Great, nifty solution. The second way you can start using Windows Azure for storage, backup, and recovery is by using a service called Windows Azure Backup. Essentially, what that service does is it allows you to back up your data center data if you're using a system center DPM, or if you're just using Windows Server, there is an agent you can download into Windows Server and associate with your storage account. And thereafter, you can point the all of your backups to happen in Windows Azure. It is very efficient. It also does compression, and it only does incremental backups, so you don't get a hefty, at the end of the month, a network bill. And you basically are doing it from a familiar interface, your System Center and Windows Server that you're already used to. Again, a very easy way to start using Windows Azure for storage and backup. So those were the two examples that I would go with if I were to just get started with storage and backup in Windows Azure, right? And there are, of course, many other ways you can start using Windows Azure storage. There are a lot of third-party solutions out there as well. Or you can build your own tools using the REST APIs because all of the APIs are open. So with that, what I want to do now is talk about a second scenario, the test and dev scenario. And I was talking with a lot of folks yesterday and day before at the booth, And a lot of folks are interested in this because this is an easy scenario to do in the cloud, right? Because you're not bound by a lot of compliance and regulatory issues for setting up test and dev environments in the cloud. Why would you want to do that in the cloud, right? Here are the few limitations of doing it on premises. It's oftentimes you are limited by hardware budget if you want to do this on premises, right? Developers basically are asking for virtual machines, and it takes a ton of time. Sometimes I've heard it take weeks or even months to get some of those machines in the hands of developers so that they can start playing with the code and testing and so on and so forth. In the cloud, it's very easy. You can spin them up on demand when you want and spin them and basically shut them down when you don't. So effectively, you're paying for only what you're using. Makes for a great test and dev scenario, makes for a great scenario to just start using Windows Azure. And the last thing is, well, on premises, you're always contending, right? You have limited resources, and the test and dev machines are always contending with the primary workloads, the production workloads that you're running. So it makes for a great case for putting this up in cloud and doing all of the testing in the cloud. The other advantage of using it in the cloud is that you can actually ship test for realistic scenarios. Imagine if you had an application and you wanted to test it for spiky traffic, right? Doing it on premises is extremely hard because for that amount of time, you have to provision those number of VMs to see if it scales or not. In the cloud, it's really easy. In Windows Azure, you can just spin more VMs, test that scenario out, and shut them down when you're done with it. So it makes for a great case. So what I want to do now is show you guys how easy it is to just spin up a VM in the cloud and just connect to it. Literally, it just takes minutes to be able to do that. Okay, I'm going back to my console here. Essentially, I go down and hit new. Compute, virtual machine. And I'm going to pick, there are two ways of creating a virtual machine, either quick create or gallery. I'm going to do the slightly longer approach because it gives me more options from the gallery. And like Carrie mentioned earlier, there are a bunch of first-party images which are already in the gallery today. And in time, this is only going to get larger and bigger as we start putting more and more images in the gallery. So today you can do Windows Server, SQL Server, BizTalk, and a bunch of open distributions of Linux. So I'm going to choose Windows Server to create a VM. It's going to ask me a virtual machine name. Essentially, that is the name that later on I'm going to see it in the console. MMS demo VM123. Enter my username, my password. This is the place, by the way, you want to keep some strong password because otherwise, if it's weak password by the time you're done, you might get attacked and the password is changed. Okay. The other thing I want to point is, we have a bunch of VM sizes that are available. There is, all the way from extra small, which is a shared core, to the largest, which is 8 cores. In time, this is also going to get just bigger and better. So I'm going to choose a small machine now. Go ahead and get started. Here is the other thing. So automatically, Windows Azure assigns a DNS name to every machine that I'm creating. So, and this is how I can access the machine thereafter. So I'm going to just create a DNS name here. Okay, looks like that's not taken. And remember earlier, we created a storage account. So the disk that is assigned to this VM, I can actually choose what storage account or it is stored in. So that if, for example, a certain region is where I want to store the disk, this is how I make that selection. So I'm going to just choose the MMS demo account that I showed earlier. Affinity group basically is a concept in Windows Azure which basically allows you to group a bunch of machines so that they're placed close together for performance reasons, right? Network latency is minimized if you place things in affinity group. So I'm not going to choose that. I'm just going to choose, instead of that, the region, right? West U.S. And this allows me to essentially choose the data center or the region in the world where I want to run this virtual machine. Availability set is yet another concept in Windows Azure. Essentially, if you want a bunch of machines not to be placed close together for the sake of availability, if you're building an application, a highly available application, and you want your VMs to be separated out and kept far away so that if one goes down, the other is not affected, or if you know one is getting updated, they don't get updated at the same time, this is how you would do it, by putting things in an availability set. So I'm going to leave that and done. Right? So it's that simple, really a few steps to create a virtual machine up and running. While that is getting created, it typically takes 2 to 5 minutes to, you know, the VM to get provisioned and to start working. I'm going to just go and connect to an already existing virtual machine just using RDP. So here you can see I have a bunch of virtual machines running. MMS demo is something that I created earlier. And let's look at the dashboard. It shows me a bunch of things like CPU percentage, desk read, write, etc., a whole bunch of things. The other thing it also shows me is the DNS that is assigned to it, that it's a publicly accessible DNS. There's an IP address as well, a WIP that gets assigned to it, virtual IP address. And it shows me other things like the size of the machine and so on and so forth. So I'm going to try and connect to this machine now just using RDP. All right, so it's as simple as that. Really, hereafter, it is nothing but a simple Windows Server machine that you're generally used to managing, right? So it's that simple, really. Provision a VM and then start using it. All right, so let's switch back. So we were talking about test and dev scenario and how easy it is to really create VMs in Windows Azure. A big question that we get oftentimes is, great, you created your test and dev environment in Azure. Now you want to replicate the same environment elsewhere. Maybe your production environment is on premises, or maybe it's in a hoster environment. How would you do that? Turns out, as Kari mentioned earlier, the virtualization layer underneath for Windows Azure is the same as your Windows Server environment, right? It's both are powered by Hyper-V. So what that means is the format of the image or the VM that's running in Windows Azure is the exact same format as Windows Server, the VHD format. And that makes for your VMs to be easily ported from one environment to the other, be it your own on-premises environment or a hoster environment. In fact, I'm going to talk about a customer example, Telenor, who did exactly this. So Telenor is a Norwegian company. A big telco provider. They were running SharePoint 2007, and they wanted to upgrade to SharePoint 2013. They didn't have enough of infrastructure to do all of the testing and, you know, load testing, performance testing, and all of that sort of stuff on-premises or in their host environment. So what they did is they leveraged Windows Azure for their test and dev environment. They set up a bunch of farms, staging environment, pre-prod environment, and a bunch of developer machines, the ones that you see on the left. Did all of that testing in Windows Azure. It took them literally weeks to finish, you know, start and finish everything instead of months, which would have taken, you know, if you had to really buy the hardware, provision it internally, and so on and so forth, right? And then after they finished all of the testing, they brought all of those VMs to the hoster environment and started running their production in the hoster environment that they had, right? And that was easy because, well, first and foremost, the VMs are very portable. It's the same VHDs running here and there. And second thing is that with PowerShell commandlets, you can write scripts that automate all of that process, you know, deploying complicated farms and setting all of that stuff up. So they did a lot of those automation-style things to make sure that the environment that they created in Windows Azure is easy to replicate in the hosted environment, right? So here's an example, a real example of a customer who did exactly what I was talking about. So those were two scenarios. Now we're going to talk, and they were fairly easy scenarios, right? There is storage, and then there is test and dev. So start using Windows Azure. Now we're going to talk about how do you use Windows Azure as an extension of your data center, which is basically a very common scenario customers always ask us, right? You have an existing infrastructure, you manage this in a certain way, but you're running out of capacity, and you want to basically have infrastructure in Windows Azure that's connecting back to your on-premises, right? And you want to manage it the same way as you were doing your on-premises. So let's take that example. So with Windows Azure, like Harry mentioned earlier, we have a bunch of infrastructure services that allow you to do exactly that. We've talked about virtual machines, which you can spin up as you need and, you know, shut down when you don't. We're going to now talk about a bunch of features which allow you to carve out a piece of Windows Azure, do a bunch of network configuration on it, and domain join back to on-premises using a VPN tunnel, right? We call that virtual network. So like I said, essentially, it allows you to do this exactly, a logically isolated container of sorts in Windows Azure. You can create subnets in it. You can assign private IP addresses on it. And you can bring your own DNS. So that's what virtual network really does. And optionally, if you want, you can connect that virtual network that you created in Windows Azure back to on-premises using an IPsec tunnel if you have a VPN device on-premises. So what I will do now is give you an example of a demo that I have in place and show through some of the steps needed in order to get something of this nature going. Again, this is not as hard as it would seem, you know, judging by this next slide. So here in this case, what I'm going to show is my office basically has a bunch of machines in the 10.1 network, right? And I have a VPN, a Cisco device sitting there, which has a public IP of 131.net IP address. And there's a DNS in my office, which is a 10.1.0.4, right? What I'm going to do is I'm going to create a virtual network in Windows Azure called MMS Demo VNet. Now, that's going to be a 10.10 network. It's a private network as well. I'm going to create two subnets in it, the front-end subnet and the back-end subnet. With those, I'm going to slice basically IP address space into those two subnets. I'm going to create a gateway there. Because the gateways exist in a subnet of its own, there is a gateway subnet that we're going to create. And then after that, essentially hook the two things up, right? The VPN device and the gateway to create that connection. So let's take a look back at the management console and try and do some of this stuff. Okay, so the first step really in order to get something like that done is create that virtual network in place. So in order to do that, I basically hit new, go to networks, virtual network. And there are a bunch of ways you can create a virtual network. What we're going to do is custom create. There are other ways. If you, for example, have already a configuration script, it can import that configuration script and create that out of that file. But what we're going to do is just custom create. Okay, first thing first, it's going to ask me the name. I'm going to give a MMS VNet demo 123. Affinity group, like I explained, is basically a logical construct so that machines that are placed inside that logical construct are placed close to each other in terms of network latency. So let me go ahead and create a new affinity group. Every virtual network has an associated affinity group with it. Okay, I'm going to give a random name. Okay. And here's a place where you can, the virtual network, you know, you can start assigning IP addresses to it. So remember, the virtual network we want to do is a 10.10 network, right? Because the office network was a 10.1 network. So I'm going to go ahead and set that up here. CIDR format, I'm going to just put 16 here. And then within this, I'm going to create a front end subnet, which is, I'm going to leave it this way and instead. And a back end subnet. And done. Right, so it's as simple as that, creating subnets inside. Optionally, it allows me to, like I said earlier, bring in my own DNS. So in this case, I want to use the DNS that's in my office, right, which is a 10.1.0.4 address. I can enter that. I basically have to create a name for it. One, two, three. And this is a place where I have to specify if I want to connect it back to an office network, right? Configure connection to local network. I'm going to go ahead and check that box. This is the time when I have to also enter the gateway subnet that I talked about earlier. And the gateway subnet at least have to have the ability to host a couple of gateway machines there. We basically keep two gateways in there, right, of active-passive mode. So I'm just going to go ahead and create a 10.10.2.0/29. Local network, this is basically my office network, right? So it's going to ask me a bunch of things about my office network, first of which is my office network name that I want to associate. I'm going to call it my office net. The VPN device IP address, right? That is the public-facing IP address of the VPN device that's in my office. So that was 131.107. And this is the private IP address of my office, right, which was a 10.1 network. Okay? And that's it. Those are the steps, really, that are necessary to create a virtual network. Well, that is, well, it's already done. So what happens afterwards is this. Essentially, what you see now is that I've created the virtual network there. The gateway is not up and running yet. So there are two steps that we still need to do. First, create a gateway in the gateway subnet that I created. And the second thing is configure my on-premises VPN device, right? That's still a missing step. So that from that end, the connection can happen, the handshake can happen. So I'm going to go ahead and create a gateway. So it's going to take a few minutes for the gateway to, you know, get up and running. Meanwhile, let me switch back to the network that I've already set up. Once the handshake has happened, this is what it starts looking like. This is the gateway IP address on this end of it. In my office, there is a VPN device sitting here. Sorry, the other way around. This is where the gateway is, and in my office, there is a VPN device that is sitting. And if you go into configure, you can, by the way, change a whole bunch of things afterwards as well. The subnets that I created, the DNS server that's using, and my gateway subnet. So once this is set up, essentially, switching back, this setup is now complete, right? The missing step that I did not show you is configuring the VPN device on-premises. And in order to do that, if it's a Cisco or a Juniper device, there are a bunch of scripts that are available in the management console that you can just download, edit basically the IP address of the gateway and the shared key, and you can basically apply that to your Cisco or Juniper device. And the handshake can happen, right? The IPsec tunnel gets set up. So let me go forward. Once you have set this up, what are the kinds of things you can do, right? It's basically going to act like an extension of your on-premises data center. And turns out you can do a whole bunch of things that you were doing on-premises already. You can run SharePoint, for example, 2010 and 2013, right? You can run custom internet sites and collab applications in the newly created data center extension. Or you can create applications, web applications, .NET applications that are already running in your DMZ. Makes for a great use case to run in this new extension that you created. And the other thing is there are a lot of applications that you're probably running on your premises today that sort of have these periodic spikes. For example, the HR application. Internally at Microsoft, we have the performance review season, at which time the application probably sees a lot of spikes, right? Because 100,000 people accessing the application over 1 month period. After that, it gets shut down. So those sort of things, it's a great place to start running those applications in this new extension that you created. The other thing that I did not show you is that in the new extension that you created, because it's VPN connected back to your on-premises, you can instantiate VMs in there and domain join back to on-premises. And that basically means that domain, whatever you run there, is going to, those applications can talk back to your on-premises Active Directory or SQL database and so on and so forth, right? Makes for another great example for running applications such as these. Okay, so we talked about SharePoint, we talked about a bunch of .NET applications. Let's talk a little bit about SQL Server. So SQL Server, with the new infrastructure as a services, you can basically bring in your existing SQL Server database and run it in Windows Azure in a VM form, right? It gives you the full feature set of a SQL Server that's running in Windows Azure for your applications. The other interesting thing about doing that in Windows Azure is that we also have a service called SQL Database, which is database as a service, right? And there are various applications where you can combine both of them to manage your databases. Here is one example. If you have a web application where a customer is coming in and, you know, the customer is registering a bunch of data, your application, for some of the data that you just want scale, you can store that data in SQL Database. You don't have to spin up a new SQL Server in order to store that data. But there might be some PII data that you want encryption and a whole bunch of other features that SQL Server has. For that data, you can use SQL Server running inside of a VM. So by combining both of these, SQL Server running inside of a VM and SQL Database, which is database as a service, you can manage your database in a much easier manner than managing everything inside of VMs running SQL Server, right? So another advantage of using infrastructure services in Windows Azure together with some of the finished services that we have makes for building applications and managing applications much easier. Okay, so we talked about this scenario. Let's talk about the fourth scenario, right? Reach where your data center won't. Essentially, there are a couple of things which Windows Azure provides a much better environment for you to run your applications than what you can do with your on-premises data center. First of which is mobile applications. Carrie mentioned earlier about this set of services called Windows Azure Mobile Services. Essentially, what those services do is that it provides a turnkey backend for your mobile applications. So if you were developing mobile apps, there is a ready-made finished service that you can use as a backend, which does things like push notifications, it manages the identities for users, it also provides some unstructured, structured NoSQL database for applications to work with. And this makes for a great use case when you're doing things like extending your internal web applications now for mobile devices, or if you want to just build quickly consumer-facing applications, which are to be working on mobile devices. And the beautiful thing about this is that there are first-party RSDKs that work across iPhone, Windows Phone, as well as Android. So for all these devices out there, your developers can quickly start building applications for mobile devices. So this is one example. The second one is websites that have global reach, right? A fairly typical scenario where, you know, cloud comes in and provides a much better way to do this. Because Windows Azure is running across the globe in 8 different regions, it is very easy to set up websites, right, which can run globally and provide for a great performance irrespective of where the customers are coming and accessing those applications. And the other nifty thing is in Windows Azure, there is a service we offer called Traffic Manager. I don't know if you guys have heard of Traffic Manager. What essentially does is it load balances. It's a global load balancing solution. It drives traffic to the right data center depending on where the traffic is arising. For example, if you have a website that is global in nature and there is a person in Singapore coming and accessing that website, it automatically figures that, hey, that user came from Singapore and directs that traffic, user traffic, to the application running in Singapore. If the user is coming from US, you know, it drives the traffic to the U.S. data center. So effectively, you can build very high-performing web applications using tools like Traffic Manager that Windows Azure offers. The other thing about websites is, like Carrie mentioned earlier, there are a bunch of open frameworks that are ready to use in Windows Azure. So what I'm going to do now is quickly show you how easy it is to set up something like a WordPress website in Windows Azure. A few clicks, and the website is up and running. Okay, so going back to my console, this is how I would just set up a website in minutes. You're going to go to Compute, Website, Custom Create. This is the place where I specify the URL for the website. MMS Demo 123, my favorite name. The region where it should be running. I'm going to select West US. So it gives me the option to basically create a SQL database or use an existing database, because WordPress or any other thing might require a database, right? So I'm not going to select this in. So that was the plain, simple, vanilla version of creating a website, right? And once that website is created, you can start building code inside. You can do a whole bunch of things. So what I've done is I've gone ahead. Earlier, I created a simple WordPress blog. And once the full building out the website is done, this is what the dashboard looks like. You can monitor. You can configure and easily scale that website that you create, right? There are different modes the website works in, free, shared, and reserved. Essentially, in the reserved mode, the website is not, it's not a multi-tenant anymore. It is not sharing its resources with any other tenant out there. And if I want, if you know, you initially create a website and you feel that there's a lot of traffic coming, you need to scale it up. It's literally dragging in the reserved mode this thing here, and more instances get spun up with that exact same website that got created. Oops, I'm not going to save those changes. Okay. Of course, if you browse the website, well, this one has been successfully created is what it says. This is the one that I had created earlier using WordPress. This is running on mmsdemo.azurewebsites.net, and that is the DNS that basically creates. So it's very, very straightforward and simple to start creating things like websites on Windows Azure and then scale them as necessary, and makes for a great use case if you were to use Windows Azure. And typically, if you're trying to run this in your own data center, imagine the type of things you might need to do, right? You have to stand up a bunch of virtual machines, put a load balancer in front to scale and so on and so forth. All of those machines have to be managed and patched and so on. So again, a great example where you can start using Windows Azure. Okay, switching back, so these were the two examples that I have for the final scenario. So to conclude, really, what I showcased so far were the basic scenarios where you can get started with Windows Azure. There are obviously a lot of things a lot of customers are doing which are far more complex and far more interesting than the ones I showed. But hopefully this gave you an idea of what you can immediately start doing with Windows Azure. So we have about 15 minutes left. We can take some questions from you folks right now. Go ahead, sir. So the question is, what technology we're using in the gateway? So the gateway, you're talking about the virtual network gateway. So those are soft Windows Server machines that are running, and they're configured that way. And of course, like I mentioned earlier, there are two gateways that get created, active-active mode. If one of the tunnels falls down, then it switches to the other one. Something of that nature, probably a custom version of that. Yeah. Go ahead. Say that again. I didn't hear that. Okay. So the question was the cost associations with the servers. So most of the pricing in Windows, there are several Windows Azure. There are several ways we price things. The basic is pay-as-you-go, which means for every service there are a bunch of meters, and there's a price associated with each meter. And if you go to the Windows Azure website, there is a pricing calculator that basically you can enter and say, hey, here is how many hours of a particular instance that I want to use, and it tells you how much it might cost you. So that is the easiest way. But of course, there are other programs like MSDN offers that we have in place, or even commitment programs for organizations who want to use at a larger scale, or even as a part of the EA attach, right, EA program that we have for enterprise customers. You can start amassing and using Windows Azure. Sir, there. How does it affect our licensing costs. So for Windows Server, it is built in the cost, absolutely.
It's built in.
It's also built in. The other way, of course, for SQL and other some of the workloads, if license mobility is allowed, you can bring your on-premises licenses as well. But for Windows Server, yes, it's absolutely built in. So at this time, you have to completely deprovision it if you don't want to be charged. If you just shut it down, you still get charged for the VM because the resources for that VM are already allocated. But that is something we're looking to address. If you do want, however, not to be charged for a shutdown VM, there is a PowerShell commandlet way of doing it, but not through the web property.
In addition, if you're using the blob storage as part of the component of that VM, you need to make sure that you basically remove anything out of that storage so you're not charged for the storage costs as well. So, question in the back? Give it a good yell.
So can you take basically Azure AD and domain join a VM as a part of Azure AD?
No, the other way around. If I have Azure VM and if I have Azure AD itself, can I make the Azure VM domain member of that Azure AD?
Basically, you're asking is it if you can use Windows Azure Active Directory as part of your authentication to that VM? Can you synchronize identity? Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm not.
Maybe if you came forward a little bit, it's a little bit hard to hear you, sorry.
So, everything in Azure, I have a VM I created, and I also have Azure AD. Mm-hmm. Can I take that VM and make it the domain member of Azure AD?
No, Azure AD doesn't work in the same way that you have an on-premise domain. Azure AD is primarily for the org identification and the user accounts, not necessarily for joining the virtual machines into that domain.
Okay,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. So is there a connection between Office 365 and Azure?
So Windows Azure Active Directory powers the identity for Office 365, so you need to spin up a Windows Azure Active Directory tenant, and that will give you your identity sync into Office 365, and then through ADFS and DirSync, you can sync down to on-prem. We have had some customers come and say, hey, if I want to spin up Active Directory in a virtual machine, sort of as a backup type scenario, could I do that? We think it's a corner case, but you can do it. It's supported. I don't know what the status is of Exchange yet, but we can get back to you on it. If we can give you our email and you can shoot it over.
Yeah.
I don't know
for Exchange
example because you have to be able to make sure that Exchange server can actually punch across to the network for Office 365, and I'm not sure if Virtual Network has that capability yet. It'll go down into your existing. I don't know if it will go across.
Yeah, today so Virtual Network, the primary way of connecting to a Virtual Network is through that VPN connection that has to have a VPN device at the other end. That's the only way you can connect to a virtual network. So the one, of course, way is you connect a virtual network over to on-premises. Although the VM is running up in Azure Exchange, you reroute all traffic back to Office. It's a possible scenario, but I don't know if the latency is going to kill you there or not. Probably will. I don't think Office 365 has that feature to connect to a virtual network in Windows Azure. Sure. Where does the VM get its internet? So every VM that's inside of a VNet, if it's a public traffic, internet-facing traffic, then automatically the routing table is set such that it gets the traffic from internet directly. Otherwise, if it's coming from a local on-premises private IP address, then it gets routed via the tunnel that's created. Not today. Split tunneling is what you're asking, right? No, not today. West US, yeah. Today, yes. Because there isn't a way for the gateways to connect to each other inside of one VNet to another. So you will have to come back on premises, and you probably have to have some routing logic on premises to route traffic between the two VNets. Console access to absolutely using PowerShell, I'm presuming. A Hyper-V console.
No, there's no Hyper-V console access to the virtual machine. It's all done through RDP or through PowerShell.
Because the underlying virtualization layer is abstracted out, right? You only get access to the VM, and you can only punch holes to the VM and see the VM.
Right, because you're accessing the guest, where when the Windows Azure platform is the host.
Sorry, I don't know if I follow the question.
In terms of what, the virtual network or,
If you lose a connection to a virtual network, how do you get it back? Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh. If you basically, you're saying you have a VM there and there's no way you can access it. Well, easiest way is to go to the management console and delete the VM and create a new one. Because from the console, from the management portal, all of the VMs, irrespective of whether those are accessible individually or not, you can still see those VMs. You can restart. You can do a whole bunch of things, right? So cloud services essentially is a container. Think of it as a container in which you basically place web roles and worker roles, which are our managed VMs, right? In what we used to, and we've had this for a while. So once you start building applications using a cloud service, that container is essentially taken and managed and run by Windows Azure. So that is a very platform as a service way of doing things in Windows Azure. So that's what cloud service really is. Can Virtual Machine Manager manage those VMs?
They're working on that right now. Virtual Machines is still in preview, so the System Center team is working through all of their support for the entire product suite. Right now, System Center App Manager is supported, System Center Op Manager is supported, and the other products are working through that as we're still in preview as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm guessing the question is, can you take Azure VHD and run it locally?
No.
So basically a remote mounting of drives?
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
No, I don't believe that we can do that today, but I was asking why you would do that.
Interesting. Okay. Well,
you can take the whole VM image and just copy it and back it up into Blob Store without having to separate the disk images.
That feature is not there today to do that, like, you know, mounting on a local server, Blob Store, an account yet.
But if you wanted to take, wanted to take that full VM image or the VHD and just drop it into the Blob Storage account, like Venkat showed earlier, when you create that, you can use that as a backup, and you can do that through Windows Online Backup and DPM. That's available today because DPM has the capability to back up the virtual machines. So you could just install that agent down on the Windows server, point it to that VM, and then have it replicate up into Azure Storage for you. It's probably a little bit cleaner to do it that way as well.
So when you expand your infrastructure to the cloud, who's responsible for patching those things?
Sorry, can you say that again? I can't hear you. Who's responsible for patching? When it comes to the virtual machine instances, the IT, you guys, are responsible for managing that. Microsoft takes responsibility for managing cloud services, the app services and the data services that you saw in that chart. And we also take responsibility for managing and patching the underlying infrastructure that is the Windows Azure platform. But any VMs that get uploaded onto Windows Azure, IT, the developer, whoever does that uploading is responsible for patching and managing the application within it. And that's one of the benefits, similar to what you have today, is you get a little bit more configuration and management control versus the platform services. We basically abstract that complexity for you, and we just manage it on your behalf. Not that we can share at this time. Any other questions? You guys are very interactive. It's good. All right. Well, thank you very much for the time. Thank you very much for the questions. Hopefully you learned a bunch today. And if you have other questions, swing by the Store Simple booth, swing by the Windows Azure booth. There's going to be folks there for the rest of the week. Thank you.